Welcome to Look to the Moon podcast, bringing together two friends with stories that need sharing. Join us, Jodie and Nicole, as we navigate life after loss, discussing topics around birth, trauma, and baby loss, and providing a safe space for others to share their stories. Hi everybody, welcome to episode 2 of Look to the Moon podcast. I'm Jodie.
And I'm Nicole. Hello
We're going to keep this in, Nicole, because it shows the realist.
Oh, shows how stupid I am. I can't even talk. That was meant to say hello again, everybody.
Yes, for the people that are listening, hopefully.
Oh, dear.
We are still very inexperienced on our podcasting journey, only on episode 2 so far. Nicole can't get her words out.
No.
We can't work the recording equipment, so don't know whether we'll have any listeners or not.
Bear with us, people. Cracking. Just took us half an hour to even be able to record ourselves, so
husband putting the baby to bed, so we couldn't ask his help, so we sort of either had to sit here or try
but we
and
did
work
it and that's what matters. We got there in the end.
So this episode,
so we're gonna be talking about Jodie's story, and she's gonna share her experience and what happened to her. Hopefully gonna talk about through your whole pregnancy right up into you delivering your daughter.
Yeah, so my story's quite a long one. I didn't have a straightforward pregnancy, but I also didn't have a pregnancy that was really, really complicated. So what happened at my birth, you wouldn't have been able to predict it based on the complications I had through my pregnancy. So I had a pregnancy that progressed fairly well. About 16 weeks, I had urine in my I had glucose in my I had glucose in my urine, so I got sent for the glucose tolerance test quite early, which came back with gestational diabetes. So I was diagnosed quite early in my pregnancy with that, from 16 weeks. So I had to overhaul my diet, had to do my blood sugars. And then eventually, about 8 weeks later, it was quite difficult with diet to manage my diabetes. So I ended up on metformin. So I had additional monitoring, which was good in a sense, but I felt like I was constantly at the hospital. Although I had gestational diabetes, it actually didn't cause any complications with me or any complications with the baby. There was no accelerated growth or anything like that. I also, when they tested my urine at that point, they also found that I was group B strep positive. Which I think until you get pregnant, and it would flag up. A lot of people don't know what it is.
No, no, not at all. Even I didn't know what it was until I'd heard of it in pregnancy. So
yeah, and it's something that women can just carry in their system, and it doesn't affect women in any way, shape or form until they get pregnant. And if they're a carrier, and it's transient, I believe, so it goes sort of in and out of your system. And it can sort of flare up and go away, flare up and go away. But if you test positive during your pregnancy, it's actually the physical delivery. So the GBS strep bacteria lives in your
vaginal. So you can't talk either.
I don't have to say vaginal very often, so I had to think about that. Vaginal canal.
Yeah.
I believe. You'll know more of this probably.
Yeah, so it's a process of delivering the baby that it would then transfer onto the baby.
Yeah, so the bacteria can transfer to the baby in the process of that, if you're actually physically giving birth to them, which can, in the unlikely event, make them very, very poorly. And they'd have to be treated in mild cases with antibiotics. The preventative is having antibiotics in labour, intravenous antibiotics, which posed a complication because I wanted a home birth, which some people say I'm completely crazy for wanting a home birth, because one, it's my first child, But I felt that it would, being the kind of person I am, would benefit me being at home, being in control. As yeah. I said in the first episode, I'm a bit of a control freak. But so we all proceeded, even though my birth plan was technically out of guidance, wanting to birth at home. I did have the support of my midwives. So we were battling with the gestational diabetes, the group B strep, but we had procedures in place to sort of safeguard.
Yeah.
And it was always on the understanding that if I was in labour at home and I didn't go into established labour within 24 hours, I would voluntarily go to the hospital.
Yeah.
So roll on to February last year. I knew things were happening the week before my daughter was born. You could tell things were moving. And then on the Thursday afternoon, my waters broke and I started contracting quite regularly, not long after that, a couple of hours maybe. And the clock was ticking then. Yeah. I had that 24 hours in my head that I thought I needed to get into established labour before, so my midwives wouldn't force me to go to hospital, essentially. Not that they would force me, but they were, you know, strongly advising me to hospital. And I was contracting quite regularly, so I thought, oh, you know, things are moving on a little bit. We got into Friday morning. The midwives came round and assessed me sort of at lunchtime, and they said it's creeping up to the 24-hour mark, and we don't think you're not in established labour. I think we, you know, due to the risk of infection, we need to go into hospital. So that was quite a disappointment, but that was always the agreement. That was my compromise, that if things weren't moving, we would go into hospital, because the risk of infection due to my waters breaking, they would be able to monitor me a little bit better. So we arrived at the hospital and the hospital were under the impression that I was arriving for an induction, which wasn't what was in our minds. We thought we were going in for additional monitoring because of the risk of infection. The induction was something that was sort of thrust upon us when we were there, like, let's get things moving. Again, I was reluctant and didn't particularly want it, but and this is one part of my memory, and I say this to my husband quite a lot, that I remember all of the details from start to finish very, very vividly.
Yeah.
But I don't remember the conversation consenting to the induction. But my husband assured me that they did go through the process and I did agree to it. So I obviously did agree to it, and I had a pessary inserted around sort of 5-ish o'clock on Friday night, and I'd been going just over 24 hours at this point, so I was fairly tired, but I thought, this induction, it probably won't be pleasant, but it'll get things moving. So I had a pessary inserted, and that
cranked things up.
But the actual physical insertion of the pessary was, I think it sent me into a little bit of shock, because I didn't realise how painful it would be.
Mm.
So, you know, when people say induce, unless you've actually been through it, you don't actually understand the process necessarily.
No.
So usually it is some sort of pessary or propess that you have inserted into your vagina that basically releases hormones to get you dilating. I think a lot of people think it's more medicated, as in it's in an IV, which that's sort of the second stage of an induction.
You can have that, can't you? I know, you can have it in a drip.
Yeah, but usually, because it's less invasive, well, they say it's less invasive, maybe, because you don't have to
really
be, well, if you're not cannulated, I suppose, it's not something, maybe.
You don't have to put a needle into you, I suppose.
But yeah, but I prefer the cannula. So I remember the light switch just went off. It was like someone flicked a switch and the contractions were coming thick and fast. And it was horrid, as anyone who knows who goes through a labour. It was quite intense. The contractions were coming sort of every 1.5 minutes, and they were lasting a good 40-50 seconds.
Yeah.
And we were telling the midwives this, and they they just sort of went, you know, yeah, this is fairly normal, this is fairly normal. And we were like, this can't be normal, you know, it was like I was getting ready to push.
Yeah.
That's what the propress was making my body do. That was the urge, you know, when they were coming so thick, so fast, and there was no rest in between. And they were saying, oh, you know, you're not, you know, I think they were talking to me and they were looking at me like I wasn't coping very well, like, yeah, I was exaggerating how often these contractions were coming, but we were timing them, and you know, they just sort of went, oh, you know, it's okay, you'll be fine, and things like that.
And how many centimeters were you at this point, do you recall that?
Yeah, so they, when they inserted the propress, they checked and they were like, you're only about 1 centimeter, like, okay, a fingertip.
Yeah.
And they think that's why it was probably so painful to
to actually put the pessary in.
Yeah, but I don't know whether everybody else has suffered that sort of pain when having an induction. It'd be interesting to know.
I was just
going to
say, well, if there's any listeners out there, let us know about your experience of induction and pessary.
Yeah, inductions and what you sort of went through and sort of the pain threshold, because it was one of the times during my labour that I felt quite a lot of pain. Even though the contractions were horrible, it was, maybe it was because I was not expecting it to be so painful. I was expecting some uncomfort, a bit like when you go for a smear, that you think, oh, you know, that's uncomfortable, but it was physically painful. And I remember being so shocked by the pain that it upset me. And I started crying because it was so, like, painful.
You hadn't prepared yourself for
I hadn't prepared myself for it.
You know, you're
so
going to go
painful
through pain in your labour, but
I thought, oh, this is like not the
this
easy
is going to be
bit
nothing.
I thought, this is where, you know, it sort of, it shouldn't start so painful, it should, like, sort of ramp up. But so the pessary was left in situ for coming up, I think it was over 22 hours, apparently. And the lifespan of a pessary is usually 24 hours, and they remove it at the 24-hour mark if it wasn't doing anything.
Okay.
But it was doing something for me, but it was still left in situ. But I'll come to that a little bit later. And because my first, I suppose, vaginal exam, when they inserted the pessary, which sort of goes hand in hand, was so painful, they limited, and because my waters have broken, they were limiting the number of vaginal exams they were giving me.
Yeah, because of the infection.
Yeah, because of the infection risk. So I remember only getting to about 2 centimetres at the next one. And then when we got round to, and during this time, because I was there for so long, I saw a multitude of different staff and different midwives. So there was constant handover. And it was very clear that the handovers weren't extensive, because we felt like we were starting afresh with the new member of staff. And we were having to explain where we were up to, what we'd already gone through, etc. So I remember the midwife checked me, and she said, look, I think you're only around 2 or 3 centimetres, but because you've been at this for, here you've been at this nearly 24 hours, but in total you're at nearly 48 hours in, and you're only at 2 to 3 centimetres, will move you over to the labour ward. So you're not, apparently in that trust at that hospital, you usually move over to the labour ward when you're in established labour, which is over 4 centimetres, I believe. So we went over there, and I remember this quite vividly. It was the last time I independently went to the toilet, which again is quite important sort of later down in my story. And we again tried the intravenous
hormone drip
as the next form of induction to see if this would speed up.
And had you had the internal pessary removed at this point?
They decided to remove the pessary at just over 22 hours in, before they moved me to the labour ward. And this is where I was around 2 to 3 centimeters. They said the pessary is obviously not working to dilate you anyway, even though it was sort of making me hyperstimulate in terms of contraction. So I'd had I remember them giving me the propress had been in situ about 7 or 8 hours before they gave me any pain relief. So I remember having some diamorphine at around midnight-ish, and this was on the Friday night going into Saturday morning, and I managed to get a little bit of rest after that pain relief. But then a few hours later, I was up and it was back to normal, same sort of scale of contractions. They moved me to the labour ward, started me onto an IV induction in hoping that that would start speeding things up. And they were, I think gradually they increase the volume, I think. And there was a big question mark, this is sort of post-labour, about dilation, because we were made aware that we were around, I think it was about 6 to 7 centimetres dilated at once we were well established into the IV drip. Mm-hmm. And I remember the constantly, sort of every sort of 4 hours, which is, I think is a standard sort of time frame, if you move a centimetre every 4 hours, that's
progressing.
That's good progression, and your labour hasn't stalled. So we were told, obviously we don't look ourselves, we're told this information, and the midwives were telling us I was about 6 to 7 centimetres dilated at a certain point. And over several more vaginal exams, we were still at the same dilation. So it wasn't moving, which was contradicted later on.
Yeah.
So it seemed like we were told our labour was stalled by the way we were dilating or not dilating, and no one was sort of acting on that stalled labour. However, I ended up being catheterised, and they were ploughing me with IV fluids. And
were you catheterised? Sorry to interrupt. No, just so that all the listeners are aware. Mm. Were you catheterised because you weren't able to pass urine at this point, or because you were so uncomfortable it was easier?
So I went to the labour ward, and I remember passing urine independently on the toilet when I arrived, which was about 3:30 on the Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
So I'd been at the hospital for around 24 hours, labouring for 48. And then, so I went to the toilet around that point. And that's when they hooked me up to IV fluids, and the hormone drip. They also hooked me up to some antibiotics because we thought, well, for the GBS,
might as well have them.
We might as well have them if I'm cannulated. So hook me up to everything because I'm already there. You might as well. And then I remember a few hours later, and I remember this vividly because my husband said to me, I've never felt so sorry for somebody in any particular moment other than this moment right there, where I had two midwives holding me up over a bedpan, trying to make me go to the toilet, because I was so weak at this point, because I was well over 48 hours in. You know, I'd not slept, I'd not really eaten a lot, although that they were ploughing me with fluids, nothing. I was stood there, they were taking my weight, and I was saying, I can't go to the toilet, nothing's coming out. So they catheterized me, they did sort of a whatever they call it, semi-permanent one, where they just drained
in and out,
in and out, they drained it, they got a little bit of fluid from me, and then they decided to install a sort of a more permanent
base,
one that sort of stays in
long term
short term, whatever you want to call it. They installed one of those, and there was nothing coming out, nothing at all. And they didn't really say much else about it, to be honest. They were kept checking it, saying, oh, there's nothing coming out. They weren't really communicating with myself and my husband, but they kept encouraging me to drink. They kept, you know, taking, putting more fluids in me through the IV. I eventually had an epidural late on Saturday night. And I remember that the only person supporting me while I was there, other than my husband, from a medical perspective, was my student midwife, who it was a delicate balance on when to call her in, because she could only be there for 12 hours. And of course, she wanted to be there to support me through the actual birth of my daughter. So she turned up sort of on late Saturday night, and she was sort of assisting in the care. And my husband recalls this, even though I was having the epidural at the time, that the other midwives and the other staff in the room were like stood at the back of the room laughing and giggling. And, you know, the guy that's sticking the needle in my back needs quiet and patience and things. And it was quite distracting. And I remember my husband being a little bit upset about that, because I'm in this position where I need to be calm,
really still.
Still And there was sort of quite a lot of commotion that they were causing at the back of the room. But that gave me some massive relief, the epidural, of course, which anyone who's had an epidural will know. It does completely incapacitate you, but when you're sort of 48 hours in, or more than 48
hours
in,
I'd take it.
You just take it. And I slept a little bit through Saturday evening. And again, so every time I had a vaginal exam, it seemed like I hadn't moved.
Yeah.
6 or 7 centimetres I stayed at for a long period of time. And we come to sort of early, very early hours Sunday morning. I'm talking sort of like, I think it was around, it might have even been like 6, 7am because it was starting to, the shift change
yeah,
was starting. Excuse me. So we got a new midwife after seeing, I think at this point we were about 5 midwives deep because we'd been there so long, which caused its own complications again with sort of communication. But we had a new midwife and she sort of checked me again. And I remember vividly she's saying that you're still at around 6 or 7 centimetres, which you think, my God, you know, you know, I've had this drip and why is it not working? Why is it not moving along? So it was getting obviously concerning that we were, you know, almost 3 days in since my waters had broken and I'd started labouring and nothing was happening. And that morning I'd started to swell quite noticeably. And they did a ward round with all of the sort of the top level consultants. And at this point I'd not seen a consultant, I'd not seen a doctor to speak to. You know, the only communications I'd had is with the midwife team and mostly my student midwife from sort of Saturday evening onwards. And one of the consultants looked at me and said, how long have you been in that state for? And we said, oh, well, quite a while, you know. Like, I'm not saying I look like the elephant man, but I was getting pretty close. That you could see from my ankles, my feet, my calves, that I was collecting quite a lot of fluid. And then things started to happen. And things started to move on. And we had one of the other consultants come to me and say, you know, you've been at this a while now. And I thought, that's a bit of an understatement. You know, we think that we need to proceed to a C-section, which was my worst case scenario, to be honest. But at that point, I thought, well, my body's not doing it.
Yeah, you there's know, not much else you could
I
do.
I couldn't
yourself.
Do, you yeah, know, it's not getting to the point where I can push, you know. And I had actually had a conversation with a midwife on Friday night, so early hours of Saturday morning. So I'd been going around 36 hours from when my water broke to this conversation, and I'd been labouring quite intensively pretty much all of that time. And I said to her, I said, look, I don't want a C-section, however, we're 36 hours in, you know, what's the process? And her response to it was, well, you're not booked in and you're not an emergency.
Oh,
and that was it.
End of that conversation.
It seemed that she put an end to that conversation, even though we raised it 36 hours into the labour.
Yeah, because surely there has to be a time scale where they would then advise, like he's done about 72 hours later, but we need to go to a C-section now. Like, there must be a cut-off point that someone has to say, come on.
You'd think so.
Which should have been before this consultant, by the sounds of things.
Yeah, so that conversation happened early hours of Saturday morning, just after midnight on Friday, so very, very early hours, before I had that pain relief that gave me a few hours relief. And so it was already floated, but anyway, so roll around to Sunday morning, around sort of 9 o'clock or so, we consented to have... or it might be slightly later than that, we consented to have the C-section, and everything started moving quite quickly then. And we went into the C-section, all a bit surreal, but I remember it quite vividly. And we thought, well, at least now although this is not what we wanted, you know, we're about to meet our baby and it'll all be over soon.
Yeah.
Little did we know that was when it actually seemed to go downhill. And we were in the surgery and the anaesthetist was really lovely, actually. She was very good at communicating with us about what was happening. And they said, you know, can you feel anything? And I said, sort of. And they were like, yeah, they've started. And it became very, very clear quite early on that something wasn't right.
Yeah.
So I believe post-labour and post-surgery that it only takes about less than five minutes for the surgeon to get to the baby.
Okay, after making all the incisions.
After making all the incisions, I believe. They've got various layers of obviously skin and muscle to actually get to the baby. So a few minutes in, it became clear that something wasn't right. And the surgeon who was performing the C-section was struggling to remove my daughter from me, literally mm-hmm. physically remove. So she'd got so far down into my pelvis that they call it now an impacted head, which I believe is, again, quite rare. And the surgeon was saying things like, can we lower the table? Can we lower the table? Can I get a step? Can I get a step to get more? And then she was moving around the table
mm-hmm.
To try and get more leverage to get my daughter out. And it was clear that they were really, really struggling. And yeah. Bless my husband, he was in a position where, you know, the curtain in front of me didn't obscure his view.
Yeah,
you know, he was seeing everything. And it you could tell it was getting quite frantic in the room mm-hmm. and they were struggling. So I've never heard of anyone going in for a C-section and actually having the baby stuck.
Yeah.
You know, you go into a C-section because you're usually stuck during a vaginal birth mm-hmm. and the C-section, they can quickly remove them. So again, it'd be interesting if anybody listening yeah. has had trouble during a C-section with the actual physical removing of their baby. It took an awful long time for them to call for help, or that's what it seemed like to us.
Yeah.
So they put a call in to the sort of head consultant who we hadn't really had much dealings with because we hadn't really seen a consultant. He was actually on the ward round that morning, but he must have gone home. So he was 20 minutes away from the hospital, or 15, 20 minutes away in the car. So he had to get in the car while we were still in surgery, and they were still attempting to remove my daughter from me and failing again and again and again. And it just went on forever and ever and ever. And I think a normal C-section takes 15 minutes or so to actually get in, get the baby out, and maybe start closing up. I think that's on average. We were sort of 30-odd minutes in by this point.
Yeah.
They'd already called for help, and he was on his way. And I think he arrived at around 40 minutes post-start of surgery. And within 90 seconds of being in that room, my daughter was out of my body.
Mm.
And I just remember it being deadly silent. And I remember turning to my husband and saying, she's not crying.
Mm.
She's not crying. I can't hear it. And I saw her sort of go past, but it was just sort of a blur.
Yeah.
And I remember them saying to me that we've got the neonatal team, like, ready.
Everyone's
and on.
Waiting.
And they were on hand. And that's all I could say. She's not breathing, she's not breathing. And she's not crying, she's not crying. Because the anaesthetist kept saying to me, you know, she needs a little bit of help breathing. So they were telling me, but I didn't know why, what was happening, you know. And then it all sort of became a little bit frantic because they sort of rushed her out of the room. And one of the nurses going to the neonatal said to my husband, do you want to come with us? And he was like, I don't want to leave my wife. And I remember saying to him, I was like, no, I'd rather you be with her than be with me. And whether it was effect of the C-section or the medication from the C-section or what was happening, I remember I couldn't control these shakes.
Shaking, yeah.
The shakes in my body.
I think it's like adrenaline.
After. Yeah, and I remember my husband trying to hold my hand because one hand was cannulated on one side because they put you in sort of a, it's not stirrups, but stirrups for your hands, whatever yeah. they're called on the hospital yeah. bed. Armrests, maybe. And I remember him trying to hold my hand and I said, I can't hold your hand because I can't control.
Stop shaking.
Can't stop shaking. And they started rushing round me after they took my daughter away and my husband had gone. And they were cannulating in my other hand, and it was all a bit surreal.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up having to have two blood transfusions. And they stitched me up, and then they wheeled me into this very bizarre room. And it wasn't like a hospital room. It had like desks in it, and just sort of like a big empty space, which could yeah. obviously fit a bed. And they drew the curtain around me and just left me there. And nobody was communicating with me. I didn't know where my husband was. I didn't know where my daughter was. I didn't know what condition she was in. I didn't know whether she was dead, she was alive, what was wrong with her. I had no idea.
Nobody spoke to you and told you anything?
No one spoke to me at all. And I was still covered in blood.
Mm.
On the bed, all my arms were covered in blood. No one cleaned me up. They just left me there. And I think because I was in shock, like I was just, I just went onto autopilot,
yeah.
I think. And I remember my husband appearing again, and he'd taken some pictures of her, and he showed me the pictures, and there was just a massive disconnect because I thought, well, you know, I'm looking at these pictures, but I've not even seen her in real life.
You don't know if that's even your daughter.
Yeah, and she was hooked up to all these machines, and my husband didn't really have any information, because, of course, I would rather them focus on stabilising her and making sure she's okay, but she was ventilated, so she wasn't breathing on her own. And then the next minute, my parents appeared, which I'd realised my husband had rung them.
Yeah.
And we were about their house about 30 minutes away. So you could see how the sort of the time was lapsing, that there was nobody communicating with us. And it became clear quite quickly that we were all going to, well, myself and my daughter were going to be transferred out of that hospital's care.
Mm-hmm.
Because they eventually said that she needs some extra help. She's not she was born not breathing. But that was really the extent of what we knew. We didn't know why she was being transferred out. I believe that the hospital we were at didn't have the facility to care for her.
Yeah.
I believe. I don't know if that was the case. I'm assuming it was, because why wouldn't they have done it there? Yeah. So they were transferred. So they started to arrange a transfer to a hospital that was about an hour and 20 minutes away from where we were. And we went that evening. And I remember them saying, we will wheel you out at the same time we wheel your daughter out so you yeah. can see her. So I'd not held her at this point. I'd seen her very, very briefly because they'd wheeled me up to the neonatal from this room I was in. But I couldn't move myself. Mm. I couldn't even twist my body to like look at her properly, and she's obviously in this neonatal bed. And then they wheeled me out again quite quickly. So I think in the first sort of, you know, 8 hours she was born, I saw her for about 2 minutes, yeah. if that, and then we were transferred in separate ambulances. And I said the journey was about an hour and 20 minutes, and they gave me very little pain relief in the back of that ambulance, and it was, from a pain perspective, the worst part of the whole experience.
Yeah.
Because I just spent an hour and a half nearly just screaming in pain because of the suspension. If you've ever been in the back of an ambulance.
God, don't talk to me about back of ambulances. Awful. You're travelling backwards, you feel every bump.
The suspension is non-existent in ambulances. Yeah. And you think, in this very day and age, when cars can drive themselves and you feel like you're in a bumper
rackety old ambulance.
Yeah, at the back of an ambulance with no pain relief after a major surgery, they'd be more appropriate transportation, but there wasn't. and we got transferred out to another hospital, where eventually they, and again, I'd not seen her at this point. I didn't know whether she'd arrived. I didn't know whether she was alive. No one was telling me anything. And we didn't know whether my husband could come with me. He certainly couldn't travel in the ambulance with us. So I remember saying to my husband, because this was a Sunday evening, if we get to the hospital that's like an hour and a half away from where we live and they deny him access, because some of the hospitals at this point, even though we were past COVID, some of them had...
They had restrictions on visitors, didn't
they? Still had restrictions. So I said to him, I said, I don't want you, when you're so emotional, driving all that way for them to turn you away and say, come back the next morning. So I said, look, go home, get some rest, pack us some more stuff, because I don't know how long we're going to be here, and come as early as you can tomorrow morning. So I was on my own, and the nurses just... The nurses that were looking after me in the maternity ward, it was like there was no connection between what I'd just been through and the fact that my baby wasn't with me, but my baby was probably in a very critical condition, not that people were telling me. And I was constantly saying to this nurse, can you find out where my baby is and what condition she's in? I just don't know where she is and, you know, what's going on. And she was like, yeah, very blasé about it. I remember ringing my husband and saying, look, they're not talking to me. I don't know where she is. Can you try and put some phone calls in and see? He ended up having to ring the neonatal unit, getting transferred to the room that our daughter was in and speaking to the nurse that was caring for her, who said, you know, we're trying to stabilise your daughter. As soon as we get her stable, we'll go and see your wife. And I remember getting woken up at 3 a.m, so going into Monday morning, telling us that because Bonnie had been born not breathing, that she may have an element of brain damage, which means that they were going to do some cooling therapy, which will not cure any brain damage she may have sustained, but it will help prevent any further damage. Because they cool their body temperature. For anyone who doesn't know what cooling therapy is, they bring their core body temperature down, and it sort of not shuts off the brain, but it makes the brain only do absolutely necessary functions, I believe. And that was for about 3 days, 72 hours that they were having to do that. And the process would then be that we would warm my daughter back up to normal temperature, and then they would run...
function tests.
Yeah. So they would... Yeah, she ended up having ultrasounds on her scalp and her brain to check for bleeds. She ended up, at 5 days old, having an MRI, which she had to be transferred as an outpatient for the day to a different hospital, which I couldn't go with her, because the care after the surgery, I couldn't walk. Like, I know that a normal's maybe scheduled C-section, it's difficult to move and get up after your surgery, but most people get up sometimes the same day, if not the next day. I managed to get up, but I couldn't actually walk. And I couldn't walk properly for almost a week. And I was in a wheelchair for about 10 days. So I think that shows how brutal the surgery was, because they struggled to remove her. So,
well, they would have had to manipulate your pelvis in abnormal positions to get his head out.
And of course, I'd allowed them to do absolutely anything for her to get me out, but to get her out, sorry, not get me out, or get me out of the misery maybe, but get her out of me. It took them a lot, and I think they did batter me quite heavily to try and do that. So my recovery was very, very long. And I remember my husband turned up on the Monday morning, and we hadn't like I say, only for a handful of minutes since she was born on early Sunday afternoon. This was now sort of 8 a.m. Monday morning. We'd seen her for maybe 2 or 3 minutes. None of us had held her. None of us had touched her. We walked into the neonatal unit. My husband pushing my wheelchair because I couldn't walk. And I remember hearing this baby crying, because the neonatal ward, if anyone has ever been in a neonatal ward, it's very quiet. Sometimes eerily quiet.
Yeah.
And because a lot of babies are preemies. So a lot of the staff were like, oh, your baby's huge. And I'm like, no, she's not huge. She's just full term in comparison to some of the other babies. But she was there was a baby crying. And I remember turning to my husband saying, is that our daughter? Is that her? You know, because we hadn't heard her cry.
Yeah.
And it was the one thing that I wanted to hear. And it made me so emotional knowing that that was her crying.
Yeah.
And even though we'd seen her briefly the day before, she looked like a completely different child because she was so swollen when she was born that a lot of that swelling had already subsided. So it was like we were looking at a different baby.
Yeah.
But she was hooked up to so many machines, and she was obviously, this cooling therapy had already started, because it had started from like Sunday evening as soon as she'd got there. But it was just so hard not be able to hold her and make that sort of connection.
Yeah.
And the whole process sort of passed in a blur, I would say, after we got to that different hospital, because we'd sort of forgotten about the labour, forgotten about the delivery, and we were just focusing on her and, you know, where she was up to. And every day she improved, which was obviously great. And as I said before, at 5 days old, she had an MRI. And at this point, she's still in sort of the high risk unit. And they had an ultrasound, and they thought that she had a bleed, because she had a bruise right around the bottom of the neck, but it was quite uniform and it went from like ear to ear. So they worried that the blood was collecting at the back of her head and her scalp, but it turns out that the bruising was actually from them physically removing her from, or trying to physically remove her from my body, that they'd actually bruised the back of her head. So she had the ultrasound, which was clear at that point, and then she had the MRI, and we got the results of that, which flagged up three different things, which was a scalpel bleed, a brain bleed, and brain damage in a section of her brain. So that was quite hard to deal with, even though the doctors sort of explained what they'd seen, and they explained that they believed at this stage that the complications that she's now got in her brain because of what she'd gone through may not cause her any problems in the future. How they know that at that point in time, whether it's is it a part of the brain that they
can recover or something?
Yeah, maybe recover, rewire, or they don't, because I know that humans don't use every part of their brain. It maybe it's in the part of the brain that doesn't control any particular function. I don't know. It wasn't explained in sort of those terms, other than they predict she won't have any complications from it, which is the best we could hope for in this situation. But because of what she went through, she needs now additional monitoring. So she's had physio since she was born. She's under a paediatric consultant. And at the time of this recording, she's just had a repeat MRI on her brain at 17 months old, which we don't have the results on because it was only 2 days ago. So we will maybe update you on a future episode with the results of her MRI. But the whole process has been quite traumatic, not just from a perspective that I went through a physical trauma, you know, my daughter went through a physical trauma, and the emotional side as well, is that because she was actively cooled and had cooling therapy, it means that it automatically has to be investigated, because cooling therapy prevents further brain damage. So when a baby is born with suspected brain damage, that hospital and that patient's care has to be investigated.
Yeah.
And it's an external, unbiased investigation.
Yeah.
By a branch of the NHS called HSIB, which is specifically employed to investigate maternity care. So the day after she was born, we got phone calls and we were made aware that this was going to be investigated further. Yeah, so because of the investigation, we were offered a debrief at the delivery hospital.
Yeah.
Which I think is actually fairly straightforward. If you've ever had an issue, regardless of what it is, and I think it doesn't matter what, whether it's maternity or any sort of care that you receive at a hospital, you can have a debrief, do you think? Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had a debrief at the hospital before the investigation was complete. And we had another debrief after the investigation was complete. And the tone of those two meetings was very, very different.
Yeah.
So the first meeting we went to, it was just the consultant that actually physically delivered my daughter, who I place no blame on at all, because and you shouldn't play the blame game, but ultimately the sort of not ending of our story, but in the process of our story, is that everything that happened to me and everything that happened to my daughter was completely avoidable. So at this meeting, the consultant that delivered my daughter was there, and the matron of midwifery was there, who I'd never seen before. And she had no involvement in my care. I don't even think at the stage that I gave birth that she was the matron of midwifery at that hospital. So she was new to the role, I think. And I remember raising all these concerns, like, you know, why was I let go so long? Why was, why wasn't the surgeon who was in charge of the C-section physically able to deliver? So it was sort of two-pronged, really. The labour, there was errors, and the delivery, there was errors. And do they go hand in hand? If the labour was shorter but there were still errors at birth, would the outcome have been the same? Or vice versa, if they would have got her out sooner during the delivery, even though I'd had a long labour and she was so far down in my pelvis, would the outcome have been the same? It's very difficult to know. But the tone of that meeting was, everything that you're describing during your labour, it was very normal. And she even said to me, which I couldn't believe, was, your labour wasn't as long as you thought it was.
Oh, that's nice of her.
And I thought, oh.
You weren't there for one.
hey, stranger.
Yeah.
Who wasn't there. I'm thinking, you know, you're saying established labour is over 4 centimetres, which, yeah, totally get. That's what you call it, established labour. But I was in early labour for over 48 hours. I didn't hit 4 centimetres till well over the 48-hour mark.
And you were hyperstimulating that whole time.
Yeah, due to the induction. So she sort of brushed it off like, those 48 hours, you weren't even in labour.
That's not even classed as labour,
And she said that. Those were the words. That's not even as classed as labour. And I'm thinking, oh, right.
So she wasn't the one going through all the pain and suffering, was she?
And I'm thinking, you're not really very supportive in this sort of sense, because I'm telling you that, you know, those 48 hours prior to what you class as established labour were horrid, and they were quite traumatic, and, you know, there was various things going on during that stage, and it was quite upsetting. And what we were focusing on mostly during this point, because we didn't have the report at this stage, was the delivery. Why wasn't that doctor physically capable of delivering our daughter, when the consultant walked in and had no trouble.
Yeah.
He got her out within a minute, which to me made me angrier because I'm thinking, well, he's capable. Why weren't you?
What did he do so differently?
Yeah, what did you do? And I asked that question. What did you do so differently? Was she not physically capable? Was she not trained enough? Was she not knowledgeable enough to perform this? Has she never seen this before? Which were all questions that the investigators obviously had. And we were sort of, not brushed aside, but our concerns were, I felt like we weren't listened to at all. And it was very much discounting our feelings and what we felt we'd gone through. And then a few months later, the report was published and there was so many things that came out in the report that we weren't aware of as parents and as the patients, if you know. I'm saying patients like it's myself and my husband that going through. He wasn't physically going through it, but he was there every step of the way. And there was things like, they didn't tell me my daughter was in the completely wrong position.
Mm.
As in, she was coming out face up, but slightly twisted.
Yeah.
So, and apparently that was common knowledge for all the midwives, but they never told us.
But you weren't aware of that.
Yeah, and the position she was in, although it's not physically, like, completely impossible to deliver naturally in that position, it's so difficult. And many of those cases end in a C-section.
Mm. Is this a position, are we talking about being breech here?
She wasn't breech.
Okay.
So she was head down.
Yeah.
But she was face up.
Oh, okay. Back to back.
Yeah, back to back.
Yeah.
But she also wasn't completely face up. So, like, her chin was to her chest, I believe. And she couldn't... And no wonder I wasn't dilating, because she wasn't... She couldn't get down the birth canal to come out. Apparently common knowledge through all of the midwives. It's in all of the notes.
But yet never mentioned to either of yourselves.
No, never. We didn't know this until she was born in the February and the report was published in the October.
Oh my God.
So we didn't find out until the October officially that she was in the wrong position. She was also pressing on my kidneys. And I, after a urine sample, they found out I had an acute kidney injury, which was quite severe, which was one of the reasons why I wasn't urinating. And because they were ploughing me with fluids and they weren't documenting my fluid input and output.
Yeah.
I ended up with hyponatremia, which... You might be able to officially give a better description of what hyponatremia is called.
Hyponatremia is low sodium, basically.
And what I was on the brink of being in a critical condition. So can you, again, because I don't have the knowledge, what would happen if my sodium levels were
So
critical?
Sodium is something that helps keep your heart in sync. So if it's abnormal, it can cause abnormalities with your heart as well.
But it can kill you
if
it gets into the critical area. And I was, I think, about 3 mil or millilitres, whatever they measure it on.
Yeah.
I think the critical level is like 120. If it drops below 120, and I was like 123, apparently, according to the records. But it's something that low sodium can affect your baby.
Yeah.
And... apparently, even though they weren't acting on what was happening to me, they should have reported that to the neonatal team post-birth.
To say that mum was hyponatremic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they didn't.
Okay.
Which apparently played a part in Bonnie's condition. So that was quite difficult to swallow. We also found out that the propess that was inserted during the induction... As soon as you start contracting, 3 in 10, or 4 in 10, as they say, so 3 or 4 contractions in 10 minutes, that propess, or pessary, whatever you want to call it, because it's the same thing, should have been removed.
Okay.
So, when they inserted that, I would say within half an hour, I was contracting
Way more than that.
Yeah. Three, every, probably four contractions in 10 minutes. And that was constant throughout the night. And they left it in situ for 22 hours. Mm. And then from the manufacturer's guidance, which is what's come out in the report, they should have removed that pretty quickly from
within
me.
Like the half an hour, like you
yeah,
said.
Maybe it's... not half an hour, but even within a couple of hours yeah. where they could see a pattern mm-hmm. and it wasn't removed, which is shocking because we've also found out that that's the only form, other than the IV, which is a later process, mm-hmm. that is the only form of induction at that hospital. And nobody
yeah,
no
one knows how to use it properly.
Nobody knows how to use it properly.
And when they should or shouldn't take it out.
Yeah. And they've not been using that, a form of induction, against the manufacturer's guidelines. Mm. So I was left to suffer for probably 18 to 20 hours longer.
Than necessary.
Than necessary. And it didn't do anything. It wasn't working other than stressing me mm. and the baby out. For a lot longer. So there was a myriad of things that came out in this report that switched our anger from the delivery to the labour, because we were thinking, if we would have known all this information, mm. we could have made informed choices about our care.
Yeah.
You know, if we would have known all this, we would have probably opted for a C-section 12 to 24 hours before she was actually born, which means we could have prevented some of the outcomes.
Yeah.
We also went into, again, why the surgeon wasn't capable, and nothing really came of that other than the fact that we found out that this impacted head, I don't think it can be called a syndrome because it's not a syndrome, mm. It feels like there should be a word at the end of that, impacted head, but that's what it is quite rare. And the surgeon had never seen it before. And I remember her coming to me a couple of hours or maybe an hour or so after my baby was born, and my husband wasn't there and my daughter was obviously in the neonatal. I'd just been rolled into this really strange room, and she came to me and went, "I did my best." And I just thought...
But at that point, you didn't even know if your daughter was alive, did you?
No, I didn't. I assumed she was, because somebody probably would have told me, but I was questioning her condition and didn't know where they were at. And she came to me and said, "Oh, I did my best." And I just thought, your best isn't good enough. Mm. Like, that doctor, if that consultant hadn't turned up, you couldn't get my baby out of my body. Mm. The outcome could have been that she died.
Yeah.
And it's only because that doctor arrived just in the nick of time that she probably is still here now.
Yeah.
And he actually came to see me, that consultant that delivered her, and he was the only person in the entire process. And I saw a lot of staff mm. during my time there, and then obviously transferring to the other hospital. He's the only one that actually said to me, "I'm sorry that this has happened to you. I'm really sorry that this has happened." And it was so nice to hear somebody sort of not acknowledge, but, you know, sort of say, "I know this has gone wrong.
Yeah,
and this is,
it shouldn't have happened.
It shouldn't have happened." You know, even though he didn't physically say that, it was the only sort of acknowledgement that we got at that sort of stage. So we're at this point now where this report has been published, and it shows, which is very scary, that it's more of a systemic problem at that hospital mm. with maternity, because it wasn't one member of staff that mm-hmm. didn't act. And the problem in my case is that they didn't act when they should have done.
Yeah.
You know, they ignored the warning signs, you know, that... The report clearly states that the birth should have been expedited a lot sooner than it actually was.
Yeah.
And they've said to us that they've put other procedures in place, like they have got sort of a dummy. I don't know whether dummy is the right word. Mm. That they are actually practicing impacted head deliveries on because of our case, which is reassuring that the staff that, you know, have got lives of babies in their hands are getting more experience from. And they're using our case as learning as well. But that, it does make me feel better, but it doesn't.
It doesn't help you and your daughter at this point, though, does it?
No.
So it's already happened.
Yeah. And, you know, I think of everything now that my daughter has to go through,
yeah,
that not, you know, other babies that have, you know, standard deliveries and everything's perfect, thankfully, you know, doesn't have to go through. She is a child now that has to go to extra doctor's appointments, and she has to have physio, and she, like, she's just been for a brain scan where we were in hospital where she had to be sedated, and you know, when you think this poor little kid, you know, is going through all this stuff because someone didn't do their job properly, or, you know, everyone was perfectly nice, there was no problem with sort of compassion or people not wanting to help. It was, you know, we weren't treated badly in a sense that we were, we felt sometimes that our voices were being ignored, but they must see, you know, women coming through all the time, and they have to keep them comfortable and things like that. But it was all of the risk factors. You know, I had an AKI, hyponatremia, she was in the wrong position, the Propess was used incorrectly, you know, they weren't monitoring my fluid output, they knew that my waters had broken like over 60 plus hours ago, even before they started considering a C-section. There was just a myriad of things, and it's scary that I saw so many staff. So is this a lack of training that this happened? Is this a departmental problem? Because that's what it's appearing that it is, because we saw so many people and there was errors across the board. From right from we stepped into that hospital to the moment we left, there was errors.
Yeah.
And it's frightening, because I don't want it to happen to anybody else, because our situation was completely avoidable.
Yeah.
That's how it feels anyway. And there's still an ongoing investigation with it, which we can maybe go into another time, but, you know, luckily my daughter is performing well. You know, she's slightly, I would say she's slightly delayed in her walking and her speech, but at the moment it's not a cause for concern.
No.
She's not hit that sort of traditional threshold yet in terms of age where it would be a concern, but she is still being monitored, and we're obviously waiting for the MRI results to come in at this point. So, I don't know, do you know much about MRIs?
No.
You didn't come across much in your line of work?
No, it's not something that I would look at, or, no.
No, because we don't really know, and like anybody who knows anything about the brain, probably not a lot, we don't know whether the brain damage that she sustained, I'm assuming it will be evident.
Yeah, so that's what they'll be looking for. So they'll be looking to see if the brain damage is still evident there. And, like, has it changed from her first MRI that she had, when it was quite quickly after her delivery. So they'll be looking to see if there is any change to it.
So it'll be interesting to see what comes back. Obviously, we're hoping that there's been no changes or development, because if there is changes or development, that means that she may have an issue moving forward. They've said that it could develop, you know, it could be a learning difficulty, it could be a physical disability.
Yeah.
But at the moment, physically, she's okay. From a learning perspective, I don't think we're going to know that until she maybe gets a little bit older, when they sort of manifest, maybe. So it is difficult to know, and that's one thing that's quite upsetting, is that we don't know what the future is going to hold for her. And we spoke in the last episode about people don't understand the impact of their words.
Yes.
And people have said to me, you know, oh, is she your first child? Oh, yeah, first, only. And, you know, we're not going to have any more. Oh, you say that, you know. I'm thinking, hopefully anybody who's listened now will understand why. Yeah,
your reasonings why you wouldn't go through it again.
Yeah, and we were quite set on one, but we weren't 100%. But mm-hmm. given the fact that we have gone through this trauma, and we also don't know if my daughter's going to need additional help.
Yeah.
In the future, which, fingers crossed, she doesn't, but we don't know that for certain. We don't want to deviate what she may need our attention, if she may need additional attention or needs in the future. But also, they've said to us there was some complications. Because the complications that I had, I would have to have another C-section again.
Mm-hmm.
They would also automatically treat me as diabetic.
Yeah.
Because I had gestational diabetes in my first pregnancy. They would also treat me as GBS.
Mm-hmm.
Positive.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, group B strep, GBS positive. I've got that abbreviation mm-hmm. correct. Which again throws up additional complications. So it really has cemented the fact that we wouldn't go on to have a second child, which is yeah. really sad. You know, and this is why I'm struggling, I think, because a lot of what we went through, I completely tuned out.
Yeah.
And it's only now that, you know, there's a case still going on, and the report was, you know, finalised way after she was born, and we have to do witness statements and evidence, and, you know, we've had to do debriefs, and it's just been so exhausting that now that's all slightly died down a little bit, that we've actually started processing what actually went on.
Mm-hmm.
And it is quite difficult to deal with, because you think, that was us that went yeah. through that. And I tell the story like it wasn't.
Mm.
It's like an outsider, like somebody's told yeah. me the story, and then I tell it to yeah. somebody else. And this is one of the reasons for the podcast, is that we can talk to other people, talk to each other, and get our stories out there, and, you know, see if people have had similar sort of experiences. Because through my story, I don't know anybody that, you know, have yeah. had, you know, have struggled with inductions, for example,
mm-hmm.
Just from my circle of friends, or, you know, this impacted head
yeah.
that I've never heard of before, and it, mm-hmm. it happened to us, and even the hospital are saying that they've never seen it before.
Yeah.
How rare is it? You know, please share your stories if, you know, anything in my story is relatable to you, and we'll tell you how you can get in touch now. Email us at hello@looktothemoonpodcast.com, or send us a message on Instagram. Our handle is looktothemoonpodcast.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jodie, for sharing your story and experience there. I think we'll wrap that up for today, but we will continue and go into a bit more depth in regards of the emotions and everything attached with your story and experience, Jodie, and just how that's really impacted your experience as a first-time mum, and for yourself and your husband, like, how it's impacted your parenting. And we'll go into more depth in that in the next episode.
Well, I hope that you not enjoyed my story, but enjoyed listening, and maybe hopefully relating if you've been through something similar. So thank you for listening, and join us for part two.
Yeah, part two. See Thanks. You then. Bye.